chance to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I am your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their community. How are you this week? I sure hope you're doing well. I hope you're baking up a storm. If it's market season where you live, I hope the markets are going good. I hope you got a lot of foot traffic. Yeah. Today on the show, oh, wow. This is such a special show this week. I'm talking with Tavita Langle and Ryan Stache from Tallgrass Bakery in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Oh my gosh, I love this talk so much. It's a fun conversation with two very special people. And I can't wait to share it with you in a couple of minutes. I'm going to give you a bit of an update first, just because things have been happening and I want to tell you about it. And then we're going to get into a talk here, a talk and a half. So please sit back and relax. Or if you're working around the bench, get like a lot of dough ready because you're not going to want to leave. Just keep on shaping through this whole thing. So that's coming up in a minute or two. Before then, I'm back at home. Yeah, I sure am. I was back in Saskatchewan last week from Saturday to Saturday, basically driving all over. When I live out here on the West Coast in Victoria, and I don't even own a car out here. I just walk everywhere. If I have to, I take the bus. But you get back to Saskatchewan, you get off the plane, you walk to the car rental booth, you pick up some keys, and you hit the road. And boy, oh boy, did I ever hit the road. I think I drove 1,500 kilometers in 6 days. That's how much driving I did. Because I was staying in Regina, and every day I would drive 70 kilometers to Moose Jaw to see my dad. He's in a care home in Moose Jaw. He's been there since August, just came off the farm last year. And oh my gosh, he's looking so good. He's really is. We had some great visits. It was a hot, hot week. It was well in the 30s every day. But I'd sit with him while he had his lunch. And then we would go out to a little courtyard outside and sit in the shade on some chairs and just visit for a few hours every day. And it was awesome. Going over old memories and him filling in the gaps of stuff that I remembered from when I was a little kid. I would grab on to this tiny snippet. Like, remember that time we went up north to see your aunt when I was like five? And who was that? And what did she do? And where did she live exactly? And he knew all of that stuff. And so it was great. Filled in a lot of gaps in my own family history. And then one day I even drove south out of Moose Jaw, because that's where my family is really from, is south in the real prairie, the real treeless prairie that you might read about or might have heard about. And we were right in the middle of it, let me tell you, because you drive south of Moose Jaw and you go over some pretty big hills and ranch land and stuff where the hills are too steep to farm on, but you can raise cattle. And then you go down, down, down from this height of land to this little hamlet called Crane Valley. And that's where my grandpa and grandma Dick lived when I was a little kid. And we used to go visit them on holidays and stuff. And that hamlet of Crane Valley was tiny when I was a kid. Like 50 years ago, it was not much going on, but there was a main street and there was a red and white store owned by Mrs. Moriden, who used to scare the heck out of me. And my Auntie Ellen would, you know, she'd have some money and we would go to the store and get candy and stuff. And there was a high school, but it's all gone now. Like the buildings on Main Street have actually like been bulldozed and removed. And I think there's maybe three houses there. But then what we used to do when I was a kid was we would drive from Crane Valley, then turn and head east and take these old back roads to get to this other little hamlet called Ormiston, where on my mom's side of the family, there were uncles and aunts that used to live there. And my great grandfather on my mom's side, I believe, owned the general store in Ormiston. And I don't think there's anything in Ormiston anymore. And then even when I was a kid, we would drive a little further on a road that was just dirt, like just blow dirt, not even gravel. You'd turn and you'd cross these old train tracks and there'd be a little mound on the side of the road. And my grandma would always say, that's Wheatstone. That's where I was born. And it was just a mound in the grass now, you know? And then you'd carry on to Cavell. And Cavell was the sort of the center of where my mom's side of the family was. And these were all folks that came over from Romania around, I'm going to say around 1912, 1913 or so. And in 1923, like 100 years ago, they built a church on a great uncle's land on a corner of his homestead. They built Holy Trinity Orthodox Church that still stands today. And they're actually having their 100th anniversary church service on the 25th of June. And folks are coming from all over. You know, the kernel of this family that settled in Canada and have now moved all over North America, a lot of them are coming back for this sort of anniversary, the centennial church service. But I spent some time there. I didn't take that old road through Wheatstone because I don't think it's even passable. I don't think the road even exists anymore. But I went south and around on the good gravel and got there. And I spent some time in cemeteries. I'll admit it. I went to the cemetery in Crane Valley and kind of did some quiet reflection with my grandparents, my grandpa and grandma Dick, and my uncle Peter, who's out there. And then I went to Cavell, to the church there, to the cemetery where my mom's side of the family is. And my great grandparents and my grandparents on my mom's side, and my mom's out there, and just spent some time on the prairie listening to the red-winged blackbirds and the meadowlarks and the buzz of mosquitoes and stuff buzzing around, and just kind of thought about how my feet felt on this land that I've stood on many, many times over the years, a lot when I was a little kid and very rarely as an adult. All the memories started flooding back. It was a very moving thing. And then I went further afield. I drove up to Saskatoon, which is about 250 kilometers north of Regina, drove up there one day and visited with Tracy Mussolini at her bakery. I've said it many times, but she's a hero of mine. Her bakery in Saskatoon, the family bakery, Christie's Mayfair Bakery, is one of the places on my vision board. When we started Orange Boot Bakery in Regina, we wanted a place like Tracy's, but down where we lived. And I went over to Bryn's place, Night Oven Bakery, the new Night Oven, the new large, amazing-looking Night Oven Bakery, but Bryn wasn't around. I just did the pop-in, took a shot, but he wasn't around yet. Or he'd already left for the day, I guess. But took some pictures of his place. Looks really, really good. Bought some more bread and headed up another hour and a half north to Prince Albert to see my sister. Visited with her and her husband and got eaten alive by mosquitoes on a little walk that we took, and then drove all the way back home the next day. So yeah, a lot of driving, but it was worth it. It was a good trip to kind of reconnect with where I am from, and then also to be really grateful when I got back to Victoria, and just that this feels like home for me now, which is really interesting. It's only been 4 years, but when we landed and I finally got back to the apartment and saw Cindy again, I was like, it's so good to be home. So it was a fun trip. And I guess you can go back and you can go visit with folks, but you can also change where home is. And so that was an interesting experience for sure. A couple of shout outs before the main conversation today. I just want to give a shout out to David Morton. Sent me a really nice note. Hi, David. He's out in Pender Island. He's been on the show before. He had some good things to say about last week's episode with Steve O'Leary and what a great conversation that was. And I couldn't agree more with you, David. That's for sure. That was a good one. We've been connecting the last few weeks, the last few episodes. It's been great. I felt really good having the conversations, felt even better listening to them a second time and then sharing them out with you. So hi, David, I'm glad you're well. Got some really good responses on Instagram from folks. Need to give a shout out to Claire and to Sonia for your comments and your feedback. Thanks so much. I'm glad the talk with Steve stuck with you. I'm glad there was something there for you. I really appreciate hearing from you as well. Thanks. You know, if you want to get a hold of me for any reason, it could be to suggest a new guest. It could be say, hey, talk to me. It could be giving me feedback about the show or just sharing what's important to you or where you are in your life. You know, you can reach out to me on Instagram at Mad Baker, but I have to admit, I don't really know how to get the messages there. And sometimes it goes weeks before I realize somebody's reached out to me on Instagram, but you could at Mad Baker. The easiest thing to do is just email me at Mark, that's Mark with a K, at riseuppod.com. Always love to hear from folks. So yeah, send me what you think. I'd love to hear from you. All right. So now the talk with Tabita and Ryan. I want to set a little bit of context here because a number of people have said, you really need to talk to the folks at Tallgrass Bakery. And they've been on my list for a while. And I didn't really know them. But when enough people say, you know, these folks are legit, you really need to talk with them. Do you pay attention? And so we reached out. And Tabita is so thoughtful and intentional about what she does. She said, yeah, for sure, let's talk. But before we talk, I want to send you something. And so she mailed me out a book, or it's sort of like a magazine, but it's soft cover, but it's thick. It's got to be like 40 pages or so at least. And it's a magazine called Anthology. I thought, oh, this is going to be a magazine that's got an interesting article about Tallgrass Bakery, so I'll give it a read. But it isn't. The entire magazine is about Tallgrass Bakery. And this anthology is the brainchild of a woman named Yoko in Winnipeg who makes these for businesses in her city that are important to her. The one about Tallgrass Bakery was like a photo journal and articles about the history of the bakery and the community where they are and the suppliers that they work with and customer testimonials. And well, it's just a love note. It's a massive love note about this bakery that's important to Yoko. And I thought, wow, what kind of a place is this that someone would go through the work and the effort and the time and the love and the care to pull together this artifact about a bakery that she loves? I was so moved reading it. And I read it through twice and I gave it to Cindy and she read it. And then I gave it to Leah, who's helping me on the show here, so she could read it and go through it. And I hope she passes it on again and again and again as well, because this is not something for the shelf. This is a little book that can move people and inspire people and just fill the hearts of people. So that was my kind of lead in to this talk. And the only other bit of context I want to share is I've got a bit of a history with Winnipeg. For about a 10-year period back in the late 80s and early 90s, I went out to Winnipeg every single year for the Winnipeg Folk Festival. It was this massive folk music festival, like 30,000 people would come, and it was in this provincial park just north of the city, and we'd camp out there and never shower and get filthy and then come in at the end and tour around Winnipeg and then go home and get the first good shower in a week, kind of a thing. It was the best fun. But I don't really know Winnipeg very well. What I do know is the Forks Market, where Tallgrass now has a location, is a very special place. And we talk about the Forks a bit here. But it's a market that I believe is built in old rail. It's like an old railway yard, but it's also at the forks of two major rivers, the Assiniboine and the Red, I believe, right in downtown Winnipeg. And like, this is the original trading post location, like not just a white person trading post location. This is an Indigenous trading post location. This is the hub. This is the center of so much prairie culture going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And so it's a really special place, the Forks, and it's a fun place to visit, but there's a lot of history and a lot of meaning there too. And I think it really comes across in this talk because these are two folks that have a lot of intention and a lot of thought and grounding in everything that they do. And so I'm so excited to share this with you. This is Tabita Langle and Ryan Stache from Tallgrass Bakery in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
We're pretty excited.
I'm so excited to meet you both. This is awesome.
In person next time.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's been, and it's just been ages since I've been out to Winnipeg too. And we used to come, when we lived in Saskatchewan, we used to come out for the Folk Festival every year and in July. But it's so strange. It's like I never really went south of the main street other than to go to the Forks. Or very like in the 80s, we'd go to Osborne Village, I think it was called there, because there was a record store. And then I found they were taking all their stuff to the Folk Festival anyway, so it was no point in going down there the one weekend a year. But yeah,
Emmylou is coming this year.
Oh really?
Yes.
Wow, so nice. Thank you so much for the book that you sent. What a gift that is to have that. That artifact to share with people. Like, my gosh,
the moving part for me was that we did not initiate or expect it.
Yes. Yes. That's
the moving part. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the woman that put that together and I was reading, like, she's done several issues. Like, what a labor of love that is to say, like, this is stuff that is important to me.
Yeah.
And I want to share it with the world. And then the work that she did to get all of the comments and stuff. So what was it like to, I guess, receive it?
I had been the main contact for most. So some trepidation, but I really learned to trust her. She has a very wry humor. She's a woman who faces immensely a lot of health challenges. But she felt she had to live in Wolseley because her name was Yoko. With all the other hippies here. So she's fairly fatalistic about being here, using her gifts. And this is one of them. She's very unassuming. But it was very humbling. It was very humbling. Also, the responses from the farmers, the other former staff, the whole thing, she would just ask me, give me address connections to farmers, to customers, and I'd give her the names, and I didn't tell the people, I didn't want to influence anything. So, humbling, I would say.
Yeah.
And joyous.
Yeah. Well, and then there one page in there mentioned DeLuca's, and then that brought back memories for me because that was the place where I was ordering supplies for our bakery in Regina. All of the little chocolate sticks for our croissants and that kind of stuff all got put on the bus back when there were buses, and then they ship them to Regina for us and that kind of thing. So yeah, I got to know some of the folks there. So it was so neat to see. It was a real treat. Yeah.
You're still there. Yeah. Tony DeLuca and I often got together. Now he's more retired.
Okay.
Second location in the South End.
Mm.
But he and I would talk a lot.
Yeah. Well, and so tell me a bit about the Wolseley neighborhood. Sort of where you seem to have a very central role in that neighborhood with the bakery.
Maybe we'll start out by shall we first introduce ourselves briefly?
Please, yes. For sure.
So I was farm born and raised, and if you're from Saskatchewan, you probably know about Hutterites, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So I was born in a Hutterite colony. Around on the prairie, flat, Gladstone, Manitoba, born at home, the middle of 12 kids. So food, the whole food thing,
mm-hmm.
It was never something, you didn't think of buying food. You grew it, raised it. So I was born with my barefoot in the soil. My first baking memory is reaching up to the table to roll buns. So ground up food from the prairie was very much part of what I did. I lived that life till I was 28. So the two things that were strongly part of my psyche was food, growing, raising, butchering, all of it, food experience, and the collective communal spirit, doing these things together with other people. That formed me a lot. But I traveled to Europe, met this man who had been a monk, who brought with him that communal experience. But boy, he was off the city. There was no question. He was from Cologne, and so we moved to the city.
Okay.
Maybe I'll say that about the beginning, and later I'll bring in.
Well, the Wolseley part, I think, connects well to that, because it is a part of the city which has that community spirit, right? My name is Ryan, and I was born in Winnipeg, in the city, very much in the city. But my mom comes from maybe a similar background to Tabita. So when my mom moved from the country to Winnipeg in the late 70s, she was seeking that kind of community, which she had kind of grown up with too. And when I hear Tabita talk about the moving from the country to the city, seeking that, what that those kinds of positive aspects of community relationship that exist in the country, and finding a place where that is happening in the city, and everybody, an area of the city where everybody knows each other's name and everybody's has similar shared goals in that way. And I think Wolseley for me has always been that place of touchstone of community.
And Ryan came to work for us in 2005, and now we are, and we are 35 years apart in age, which is quite wonderful, because Ryan is part of our succession plan, and we're just waiting for the lawyers and the accountants to finish their work finally.
Oh, okay.
Party. Yeah. Ryan has baked for us, has come and gone. I always think of him as our human homing pigeon. Yeah, so it's a great delight to be doing this together, as one of many things we have done and will do together.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, that's the congratulations, Ryan. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So now we're at the neighborhood question.
Right? Yeah, maybe.
I say what Wolseley was like. There were, because Paul and I both came from Christian communal backgrounds, we were looking for a church in the city that could maybe provide or honor that.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to us, and we found out fairly quick and directly that there was such a church already right here in Wolseley called Grain of Wheat. They were starting out as a house church. And part of what they were trying to do was be a witness to positive social change, but also be not just a church you go to on Sunday, but be communal. So to join that church, you had to actually live in the area. And there were many households living together, car sharing, and they were big into issues. Tommy Douglas style, social justice was a big theme.
Right.
So that Grain of Wheat became a part of the Wolseley fabric. And the other strong presence, and there were many, and Ryan will talk about some too further than, Harvest Collective. And I think to describe the neighborhood, you have to talk about what was happening in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The 80s were a time of incredible change, but farm crisis was a big deal because global trade was getting its legs, and which resulted in agribusiness becoming major agriculture players, which decimated many small farms. And one, because one of our church members was working for MCC on agricultural issues, we became aware that this was happening all over the world. Small farms were being forced out. In the 80s, farm prices were the same as they had been 100 years before. The math just didn't work for small farmers. So there was farm suicides. And in church, we started saying, should we be trying to do something about that? So, and another place that was very secular, but we were all a part of it, was working on the same concerns. It was Harvest Collective, which as a counter movement to all of this was establishing and selling organic food.
Right.
And it was a place that if you lived in the neighborhood, most likely you could be a member and work there. Food politics were front center. And that was such a rich gift because you met your neighbors who were not part of the church. And you got, it was common ground.
Yeah.
And Monsanto and trying to buck that trend. The other thing that was happening, that's the last I'll say, it was the science all over the world was coming back saying, yes, these herbicides and pesticides are destroying our waterways, our topsoil, and endangering our health. So that those were things we talked about both in church, in the street, at Harvest Collective, and yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's so true. Like I was, back then I was sort of high school, just starting university and that, but my parents were farming on my grandparents' farm outside of Moose Jaw. And I remember the 80s, that was also they called it global warming then, but the whole climate change thing was like everybody that's up in arms about it now, it's sort of like, yeah. And it's been 40 years of people that were aware of it knowing, because I remember just the droughts in the mid 80s as well. And
yes,
you know, I went, and you were talking about farm prices being the same as 100 years before, you know, when my mom passed away and I went through sort of the archives and I was helping clean out sort of a lot of the farm papers. And I was looking at, you know, tax returns that they did for like from farm income in the 80s and 90s. And it's like, they worked so hard for no money, you know, like just no money at all. You know, I don't know that they made $30,000 in farm income a year back then, you know, and that, and it was just pressure to sell their small piece of land, right? You know, that was all it was. It was you had to get big or go home kind of a thing.
Yeah.
It is, and it's, I don't know. I'm thanks for sharing that story because it's like, or that history, I guess, because I feel so odd myself just living there and being part of it and being totally unaware of all this stuff that was going on at the time, right? Like, and that idea of real community living and building it up, you know, like we just didn't have that as much, like anything like that where I was growing up in Regina, you know.
Well, it also, I think, allows a certain kind of response, right? So when the community identifies that there's an issue and Tabita talks about that there were these issues going around within these certain groups, I think if you're looking at those issues when you're on your own, it can feel very isolating. No one really knows what to do about it. But as soon as you start looking at all of the different people in your community, the different resources and skills that they have, then it allows for a kind of response, which is a little bit larger than, or much larger than what the individual alone is able to achieve. And so I think that like hearing that it sounds like the genesis of what Tallgrass is, it comes from those conversations that are happening and realizing that there can be an actual response to it.
Yeah. And that if you have even a small group of people talking about it together, it's then you know, I like to think that's the prairie way. It's like, okay, well, what are we going to do? You can only talk for so long and say, well, we have to do something. Yeah.
Which goes back to the church, which was trying to be not just a Sunday go to church, but living together, being together in the everyday.
Yes.
And so trying to identify what are the things that we are doing individually that we could be doing together. Like car sharing was one, and living together was another, but what were the activities? And three of us women came from Hutterite backgrounds. And so we said, we're all baking bread. So were most of the people at Harvest Collective, all baking bread. So we had this idea, why don't we look for a place where we could do it together? And at Harvest Collective, we got the name of an organic farmer who, when he was told to go big and go home, he ordered a few mills and started shipping to Europe his organic grain, getting way more money, but risking.
Yeah.
And building up his topsoil. And when the herbicide and pesticide people first came to his land, he said to them, is it safe? And the agent said, of course it's safe. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't. And he said, good, bring some in. The wife will warm it up and we'll eat it. And the agent said, no, it's not safe. And he said, I am not interested in anything that's not safe to eat, to put on my land. My land and I are friends. We eat together. And today, his topsoil is in textbooks. But Mr. Anderson was somebody we met at Harvest Collective. And that's where we got the idea from. Why don't we buy grain from him? Mill. A young couple who was also part of our church, part of Collective, said, well, they had just gotten married. Our grandmother gave us money to buy china, but we intend to travel for a few years before we settle down. Why don't we use the money to buy the mill and then the bread co and start a bread co-op? So the logical place was the Anglican church, which had a communal kitchen. So we went to the rector, and he was a remarkable man. He said, I have constant guilt about how underused that kitchen is. So yes, please do come in. And so from the get-go, the co-op was this blend of neighborhood church. It has since been copied by other people. I would like to publish it as a model and just give it away for free.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It was built on the Hutterite model of pairing experienced bakers with new bakers and cooks and mentoring. So if you had never baked before in your life, you could still become a baker.
Sure.
It was also built so if you couldn't pay for the bread, you could get work credits, which allowed also, we had several welfare moms who from the neighborhood who became bakers. And it was really a good model. The rector felt, because we baked Saturday, he felt that was the point where his sermons improved, because he could smell the bread. So think about it. It started in the church as a communal experience. And during that time, none of us ever talked about starting a business. We just enjoyed baking bread, eating bread, and delivering it to houses and little red wagon. Mm. Yeah. So in the midst of this, he was growing up. So back to you. What was Wesley like?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, so I was born in 1984. So I was certainly alive and conscious when the inception of Tallgrass was happening. But my mom was also part of the Harvest Collective. So I went there as a kid and drank the soy milk before everyone was drinking it.
Right, right.
Not always enjoying it, maybe in the way people do. You know, back then those health foods were for kids, where it's not as enticing. But you know, when you grow up in that environment, then you learn, you find those touchstones, those enjoyments in the people that are surrounding it, right? So I'm, you know, on Saturday morning, And this was after then Tallgrass had established in 1990 as established yeah. as an actual location in business on Westminster. And you know, my mom would hand me a $5 bill or a $10 bill and say, go, you know, go down to Tallgrass and get some cinnamon buns. And it was that my introduction to that was at a fairly ground level, you know, and as a customer, as someone who was enjoying it first. Yeah. And so I think that lends, but maybe to be, do you want to talk about a little bit about the start of the bakery itself?
Well, what happened is, because none of us, when we started milling, we were doing it as a response to helping the farmers get more money for their product. I had never tasted freshly milled grain.
Right.
So the flavor was an amazing surprise. It tasted better. And that, and you know, in communion, when you say taste and see that God is good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people tasted and saw that it was good, and the demand became untenable out of the bread co-op on Saturday. So we started baking Wednesday as well. But then the question became, has this become big enough to become a business? Could we make a living in our neighborhood? Could we employ local people? Could we pay the farmers fairly? So then it became back to the church. Should we risk this? And one of the elders said something that has, I think, really ensured that we have endured as a partnership. And not all the partners, again, were from Grain of Wheat. One of them, who had expressed interest, was actually a research scientist I had met, because I spent 7 years as a head cook in the Experimental Lakes area.
Okay.
Where you met scientists from all over the world who were trying to clean up the lakes.
Right.
So she was a Catholic activist, and she and I became friends. So she was very interested in a business that would have the environment at its heart. And she was also one of the few people who had money. She was willing. She was a single mom, very courageous. So we went to the church, and because the church was also very much about making personal decisions with discernment of people in the church. So should we do this? And one of our elders at the time, and we went to the Y to learn how to do business plans. None of us had any business degree or experience or any baking degrees. I was the most skilled baker they had, and I had never been anywhere near a baking school. Yeah. So he said, it's not your business plan that interests me. He had been shepherded a few churches, and he said, I want to know what your conflict plan is. Because when I look at all of you, you are very different. And it's not will you have conflict, it's when. What will you do? And that was, I think, he was giving us an incredible treasure, because we had to commit, if we wanted the church's blessing, to make a conflict plan. So the early one was, we would come to the elders, to the community, and if that wouldn't work, we would reach out to a mediator, because mediation was becoming a thing. Winnipeg was very pivotal in that. So that, the mediator as a daily part of our life, he isn't even an owner yet, but he's been to mediation.
Yeah.
And he and I have been to mediation. Yeah. It's just a part of our life. Our staff, they teach us skills. So that was a spiritual investment that paid off. So in those early days.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious that a bakery, like any organization, needs to function with lots of different types of people in there. And it it's part of the strength is that it functions despite that people are coming from all those different perspectives. I mean, that's, to me, that's the definition of community in that way, is that people who stick together despite their desire to sometimes to not want to work together because we are all there for that same purpose. And so there needs to be a way of doing that. And we, you know, in the bakery nowadays, we try to focus that on the work as well, like making it about work and what we do and focusing it on the product and the relationships between each other. But that's always only ever been strengthened by things like mediation and a focus on community building from within the organization. And that has maintained, that's because of the way it started at the beginning with those values as being important, that's now able to continue into the history of the company and how it thinks and functions as a unit.
Yeah.
I also will just add, it has allowed us to be more diverse as a staff.
Yeah.
And be very open because we value diversity in agriculture. And so from the beginning, we were very welcoming of other cultures, of gender, gender things. Like it's just, you can risk more if you have somebody you can go to help you sort out. And our mediator lives up the street and says, it's my bakery. I want my bread made in peace.
So can I ask more about that? Because when you were speaking, Ryan, that's exactly what I was thinking, that if you want diversity and more people are outwardly saying, like, I want diversity, then it just stands to reason that there's going to be, I don't even, we'll call it conflicts. But at least just differences, like, because you're learning all the time, that, and you asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
That so can you share a bit more about sort of the role that mediation plays? Because I don't know that I really understand. I guess when I first thought about it, I thought, oh, between the owners, if the owners have a disagreement, we'll settle it. But it sounds like it can go deeper than that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and sometimes it does just look like regular kind of conflict resolution. Like you talk about mediation between the owners. I mean, that is at its root, it's two people sitting down and talking with somebody who's helping them talk those things through. And so on a one-to-one level, that is always what it looks like. But this approach can be also applied not only to the ownership group where they sort of need that on a more regular basis in order to make the kinds of decisions, because whether they agree or not, like, you know, but in terms of having a conflict between staff, you know, between bakers about whether a product should be made a certain way or the other way, we don't take a top down approach and say, well, no, neither, you know, both of you are wrong and both of you need to start doing it this other way. I mean, the bread still has to get made. And so within a business, sometimes that will be the answer. But it's also about, it's not just about giving that answer, walking away and expecting the problem to go away.
Right.
When you're working with people who we take people seriously. People have real things going on in their lives and real reasons why they might feel certain ways, even though that they're not always able to communicate that. So the mediation gives them a chance to sit down and fully express those things which are being communicated and really just to listen to each other. It's not necessary on a daily basis, but there are moments, but being open to that process, I think is where the groundwork is laid for solving and for preventing those kinds of maybe those conflict in the future. So people see it also as an option. And if they come to an end of working with somebody and say, I just don't know where to go past that, there's always an option. There's always a way to go further in solving those disagreements with each other.
And the way it's built into the whole operation is because in Grain of Wheat, still to this day, decisions are made by consensus. Mm. And we took that at the bakery. We've never voted. And our lawyer, who was also from Wolseley, when we started out, encouraged us to build in voting, but as a last resort. Mm. So we hire people, we make them aware of if they have issues, who they should talk to. But if they find they're not getting heard, they can call the mediator direct. Every staff can do that. And yeah. some of them do. Mm. And all us. Yeah. And that's, it's a way of being honest. Mm. Lyle calls it from the holy grind. Like grain to become bread has to be ground. Mm. Yeah. We do too. Mm-hmm. Becoming one bread.
Yeah.
But you know, I have to think that just having the culture, having that mindset at the start from you just has to, it just has to help with the whole crew, like just the story, you know, for an example of how long Ryan's been part of Tallgrass, you know, it's like, that's not as common. That's not common. I always get so excited when I hear someone's been at a place 10 years, 15 years, you know, longer, because it's not common, it seems, in our industry. Like there's so much more movement, but it's sort of like and I've been asking myself, you know, in other contexts, just like, well, it's how much does communication and actually being willing to be open and talk and to listen and that kind of thing, how much does that play in people staying and making a career out of it? You know, yeah. And I think it plays a huge part.
Right now, there's lots.
I mean,
yeah.
Fivers.
That's, I mean, right now. I was going to say, it's certainly not just me within the organization, not all. It's actually, you know, there's quite a few people who have been around for almost, if not, I think there's a couple that might have even been for even longer. So there's people who, for different reasons, everyone might have their own individual reasons why that community has been able to sustain them. But you know, for me, it was the longevity, I think, of it was getting into the baking side. You know, when I started at the company, I actually started, I think I had some previous experience working at a senior's home. So I was doing serving and working a little bit with food. And so I was hired, I think, on the deli side, making sandwiches. And within a year or two of that, I picked up some really, really great skills. And within a year or two, I looked at the baking side and thought, wow, there's all this interesting things happening at night. I mean, what happens at night? I don't even know. You know, they're kind of mysterious. You know, the one, I remember one baker, Vaughn from the earth.
Yeah.
He told me, and I don't even know if he was making this up or not, but he told me that night bakers are weird because they like to eat dough at night. You know, and I think he was referencing tasting a little bread to see if it had enough salt or to see if he'd forgotten the salt or something, just giving it a little taste check and then spitting it out. But in my mind, that made such an impression, like, oh, that these yeast eaters, you know, like eating at night in this weird magical place. And actually, so me, it was kind of a weird inverse, like most people are afraid of the night shift or the night stuff, but that was actually part of the attraction for me. And I think these days I'm happy to do less night shifts more than more, you know, having put some time into it. But I find that there's something dynamic about, like, that there's always more to go and more to learn. I think that in baking, for example, that's a huge one. But that everyone, you know, that in the wider community within the organization, people have different long-term goals and they are able to, you know, that we can provide a multifaceted way of that they're able to approach that. You know, some people started in one place, move in or come of age within the organization, realize that there's a skill that they have or that they're interested in developing that we haven't done yet or that no one really knows about. And we think, oh, maybe this person, you know, you like taking pictures. Maybe social media is a place for you. Maybe, you know, are you seem to be really good at working with, you know, like with numbers and spreadsheets. Like, huh, maybe you could reform some of these recipes or reform some of these, you know, systems which you just haven't had to look at yet. So, yeah. So creating, it's like us, it's about us maybe also opening up those needs within, you know, it's like we have to be, you know, Tabita has had to tell me numerous times over the years, you know, remain curious. You have to remain, you know, the curiosity about why people are interested in things helps us then maybe create ways within the company that they can find their place.
Sure.
I think the other thing we were clear on from the beginning is, and we were wise to build into our owner's agreement, was that owners had to be working. They didn't have to bake, but they had to be involved with the bakery, and foreign ownership or absentee ownership wasn't going to be part. And the other was that we did not want to franchise, because I don't think you can live out the local piece. So some of our bakers wanted to start their own bakery, and we were very open to helping them. That's our version of. So we have helped some of our bakers, and we have great connections, start bakeries. And that's been very gratifying.
Sure.
We also decided very early on that no one really owns recipes.
Right.
Our recipes are available free. Like, if you want them, you do the math. They're pretty big. Break them down. But, and I just got a thank you from a customer last week who said, when you said I could have the lemon cookie recipe, I didn't believe it. And she said, so now it's the one thing I'm not buying because I enjoy making them.
Yeah. But that also, you're giving an awful lot of joy, and I'll call it family joy, even though I don't know this customer situation, but it's like, you know, because if you bake 3 dozen cookies, you're not going to eat them all yourself. You've got to give them to somebody, or you've got to share them with somebody. And so you're giving them that gift, you know? Oh, for sure. Well, and that's the thing. Like, I don't, I've had the privilege of talking to so many people through this show over the years, and it's very rarely does anybody say, oh, I've got a secret recipe for this or for that. Cause there's, come on, it's the same. Like, if I did one of the recipes in the book here, it wouldn't turn out the same anyhow. So, we're taking the same staple ingredients and making something special with it.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why also I think, you know, bakers or, you know, people in the work in food generally can move around a little bit and get the experiences from other places. I mean, like Tabita was saying, you don't need to go to baking school to learn how to bake, but it does, you know, it helps to draw on some of those experiences. And so I think for me coming up, you know, like I was 20 when I started at Tallgrass and was not in the food industry. So that I didn't have a lot. I didn't have a giant wealth of food information to draw on from my life. I cooked at home a little bit with my parents or whatever, but I hadn't come from a long stream of business of bakeries and then went on, you know, then figured, oh, this is where I want to go. I just landed in the right place first. Right. And so I felt like over the years, I've had to kind of do a few different, we can call them sabbatical years at this point. I lived for a couple of years in Hamilton area, working at a bakery there. I did a short stint in Germany just before the pandemic, working in Hanover. And so being able to go out into the world and see those things, but then to also come back and collect and then form the Tallgrass version of that.
Or to
create the Ryan at Tallgrass, and then we pass it to somebody else. Or I even just flag a recipe for somebody else. You know, I say, oh, this one looks interesting, but I'm not sure where to go with it. And then you plant the seed in somebody else, and that person then creates their own. And so it's a dynamic version of making old things new, right? And that is always going to be a unique thing. So.
And I think a bread companion that entered our life, 15 years ago, was a French baker who came through the European 7-year apprenticeship and comes from a 5-year family generation of bakers. So he brought a lot of stuff. He's very generous and always claims I taught him as much because he had never baked with whole wheat.
Okay, sure.
It was his first experience, and the milling and the baking was very new to him. So having his expertise has allowed us to develop way more into sourdough and the French croissants, Danish, which are now becoming a real thing and just the problem of keeping up. But he also is very democratic and humble. So it's quite awesome to watch him teach people who barely know English how to make and hand roll the perfect croissant. Mm. It's he's very in sync with the philosophy. So
Well, and it's like, like you're taking you're taking as many inputs as you can, you know, and then combining it with the richness that you have in your own community. It's beautiful. Yeah.
I just wonder, I'd like to mention,
please,
kind of who were our teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So beyond the experience, and I want to shout out a book you might be familiar with, Rooster Neen, Understanding the Food System from Land to Mouth. And he was an Anglican minister, felt he could, that there was a witness needed to all the changes happening in the food system in the 80s.
Okay.
And he wrote the book, The Rape of Canola. He took Monsanto to court. He was a troublemaker. He also, and he had a basic belief, if you come to a city, you don't stay in a hotel. If a community invites you, it should bed you and feed you. So we billeted him.
Okay.
And so his book, he still is. And his big thing was, if you're a person of faith, communion is God's food plan.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets the same, equal share. And he said, I've never been in a communion where it was said, oh, we ran out of bread, you can't have any. Like, so that book was, and we spent evenings with him because he was staying with us, was big. The other one, and I don't know who recommended this, is Schumacher, Small is Beautiful.
Yeah, oh, I've got, yes, yeah.
Yes,
I've read that one, yeah.
And the other person who I think continues to inspire is Tommy Douglas, who mm-hmm. was very much alive then.
Yeah, yeah.
He had that sense of make it work for everyone.
Mm.
So in our hiring, we also hire people who are at risk. And mm-hmm. that's been quite difficult often because we have people who have mental health issues. It doesn't always work out.
Right.
We always believe it's you have to hire from the community in which you live.
Right.
Be as much of a rep as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So cross-cultural and cross-economics. Yeah. It's a thing for us. Yeah, I just wanted to get that in.
Oh, yes, but thank you for that. Yeah, and it certainly, it's like, and the first book you mentioned, I've never heard of before. I'm going to take a look. I'm going to look that one up for sure. But I have a copy of the Schumacher book on my shelf as well. I refer back to that one. But
he gained traction during COVID a lot.
Yeah.
Urban Mail said an awful lot of people are going back.
Oh, okay.
To reading Schumacher and we sure noticed that the support for local food was big. Yeah.
Now I know that you've expanded beyond the Wolseley location. Like you're at the Forks, and is there a third location as well? No, or just the two?
No, just the two. Well, there's another aspect in the Forks market. There's really two separate things going on in the Forks market.
Okay.
There is the bakery itself, and there is Grassroots, which is kind of like our kitchen side. Basically.
Gotcha.
We produce all the fabulous soups and take-home meals and sandwiches and all the deli stuff which comes. And we sell them sort of like interchangeably at each.
And we preserve.
Yeah, and then preserves, exactly.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
We have Mrs. Penner's Mennonite. Yeah. Grandmother's pickle recipe, which is very popular. So I was just told by the person who watches the numbers, could I please order 500 more pounds dill pickles? I talked to the farmer. So
we're going off on a tangent now.
Yeah.
You mentioned pickles because growing up, so the Baildon Hutterite colony was right near where my grandparents' farm was, south of Moose Jaw. And grandma used to get, she used to get feathers for feather pillows all the time and pickles. And there's near Belle Plaine, Saskatchewan, outside Regina, there's a Hutterite colony that's always in at the farmer's markets.
Yeah.
And you go in August and you buy a big bag, like 50 pounds of cucumbers and three bunches of dill, and you go and you make your own pickles and stuff.
Yeah.
And when I moved out to the coast here, and we'd go to the farmer's market in the fall, and we're like, where's the cucumbers? Like, where's the, you know, because you're supposed to be able to buy, like, you know, a 50-pound bag and go put up pickles for the winter or whatever. And
that's a prairie boy to do.
Oh, I know. I'm telling you. And it's like, we got a jar of pickles. Cindy, my wife Cindy works at a school, and we got a jar of pickles from one of the teachers that made them. And every time I have one, I go, oh, that's a good pickle, right? Because it's, yeah, you got to do it. That's the prairie thing. Like that's why you dig a basement, is because you're putting all that stuff down there.
Yep. We call it summer in the jar.
Yeah. Yep. My great grandmother, out at her homestead, it was like in the kitchen. It was just the hole in the floor in the kitchen that you pulled it open. You went down in the dirt cellar and you'd come up with two jars and you'd have lunch. Oh yeah. I'm going to cry.
I'm so glad you had that experience.
Oh yeah.
It is grounding.
It is.
When the prairie soil has a power.
Yeah. And we have those, short seasons, and it's like, and now that I'm out on the coast, like I whine about making it through all the winters, but it's like, that we did on the prairies, but it's like that short season, you sure did a lot of work in the summer to get you through the winter. And there's something about the cyclical nature of it that I love, but yeah. But sorry, thanks for letting me wander. But I was curious. I'd love to hear a bit more about making the move out to the Forks, and because for something that is so grounded in the community and the neighborhood where you are, I can imagine there's a pretty good story about making the decision to say, yes, we're going to go into the Forks and that kind of thing. And I'd love to hear it.
Well, the building where Tallgrass first is, it was 15 years ago, 17, was over 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It had not needed repair, which is a real testimony to the workmanship of those early builders. But it did need repair, and we knew we'd have to close down. We were looking for a place to be at temporarily. We also became aware that as unbelievably supportive as Tallgrass was in Wolseley, if we continued to pay fair prices all down the line, it would struggle to provide for mm-hmm. that. Because the demand for the product was growing. We need more bakers. The place was 400 square feet after all, right? So we explored going. We knew there was a bakery at the Forks that was closing. So Lila and I were sent down on Friday to see about the possibility of renting it. We still weren't thinking of going there because we are always closed Sunday. And at the Forks, you have to be open Sunday. So it was, as a long term, it wasn't a thought. So we went, we saw it, we met with some people, and they said, we really would like you to come down here for good. And Lyle and I kind of, at four, got into our car, rode back to Woodsley and said, not going to happen. And then I don't know if it was me or Lyle who said, you know what, Lyle? Let's pray it for the weekend, just for the heck of it. That was a pretty sincere invite. And we did. And Monday morning was always our meeting as partners. And when I had prayed it, and for me, the Sunday was a big barrier. I mean, it still is difficult. And I got this distinct impression that a voice was saying, think outside the box, woman. And I thought, well, that's strange. It's one of the Ten Commandments, right? So I said, Lyle, so did you? And Sharon was the other partner then. And Lyle said, well, that was the weirdest thing. I said, well, what did you hear? And he And he said, I heard a voice say, I love the market. My people are there. And so then, but we still couldn't get over the hump. So we did what we usually did. We did a discernment group with the church, but also with the rabbi who was a regular customer. Because we said, if anyone has studied the Sabbath, it's not the Christians, it's the Jewish people.
Yes.
And his thing was, he believed organics was the new kosher. So he was very supportive. And he said, the Sabbath rule is about sustainability. If you do it, you have to build in sustainability. And so it felt like it was a go. And the Forks Market, in many ways, the history of it, the indigenous history,
yes,
of the trading grounds, a place where wars have never been fought, has become, it's become very precious and special in a very different way than Wolseley.
Yeah.
They both have great charismas, I think. But for the first year, we did not expect it to take off the way it did. Wolseley, not the first time, not this either. It really took off. So for the first year, I hardly went to church. Yeah. And then Rabbi Rose, who had met one of our church people and heard this, sat me down and gave me a lecture. He said, when I bless this, I did not mean for you to stop praying with your people. I know you pray. That's not an issue. Praying with your people is different. So my daughter's going to come to work for you. And then we hired also some, yeah, just turn it out. We hired also some Muslim people.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we try and make sure that people who want to go to church can go to church. They
right.
don't have to work every Sunday, but that's still, I'd say, a big challenge.
It's been an interesting, I mean, I started at the Forks, and so mm-hmm. I started a few years after it was that it opened there. And what struck me over the years, having now worked at both locations and working at both locations on a regular basis, what struck me is that they really have, they're sort of like two different kinds of organizations within the same organization, you know, and not, you know, it's not a franchise where it's just a cookie cutter. Because when you get a second one, then there was decisions like, are things the same at both locations? Do we have new product? And the fun part for me is that we literally just keep asking those questions over and over and over again. We don't stop. I mean, they are both living in each their own way, even though they're owned by the same people and managed by the same people. And so there's what we call regional differences,
yes,
at each bakery. Yes. And some stuff we say, you know, this really has to be the same. And then other things we say, no, it's okay that one site's a little bit different than others. And sometimes that causes much consternation amongst the staff that have to work at both and constantly remember all the different things, or even customers that ask straight up, you know, like, why is this thing different here and over there? And I say, well, it's just because it was arrived at in a different decision-making process. And it is now you get to eat it in its region, and then you can, why not travel to the other, you know, to the other one to see if you like that one, that version better or something, you know?
Yeah. That's one of the things I have a very romantic notion about Winnipeg as the city, in that there are those neighborhood, those regional differences, like you said, around there, where I've got friends in sort of different areas of the city, and it seems like they've got a completely different experience based on where they're living and stuff. I think that's a really neat solution, to be honest, yeah, with you. And it's because then, you know, say what you like, it's like tall grass in the Forks is going to fit in the, yeah, Forks, and, yeah, tall grass in Wolseley is going to fit in Wolseley. And that's beautiful. Yeah.
And so when we think about like the future, I mean, there might be another place where we fit, you know, it could be. Well, we can keep asking ourselves that question, you know, or we ask other people, or ask communities, do you think that's a place where we would fit, or where something else? You know, and I think what I really like about the Forks in general is that it's drawn I mean, we like to draw the circle as wide as we can in terms of who our community is, in terms of, and also the stakeholders of the organization. You know, it's not just us within, it's without, it's also everyone around us that we affect and are part of a larger thing, not, you know. Yeah. So I like, you know, the Forks is able to draw that circle as wide as we needed to, exposing us to that and having like an open, you know, both our bakeries are also open in the back. So the baking space is both open for all to see in all of its craziness and sometimes not aesthetically pleasing as some people imagine, right? But that's all part of it for us. And so then we can make those connections to in the market, you know, making those connections to other people who are interested in the same kinds of things, mm-hmm. then allows us to learn about other people in their communities and the communities meet there. Yeah.
And I think we've definitely may explore a third community because the canning is getting out of hand in a small space and the soup right. and meals.
Yeah.
But we have made a commitment that all the partners now, we will not leave the inner city.
Yeah. Right.
We will not move to the suburbs. We've been invited to Tuxedo and to Saint Vitale, but we've made a commitment. We want to stay in the boundaries of the old city. And yes, at the Forks, the mentally unstable and the homeless sometimes present a problem. But we don't want to run away from that. We're there, people in our community.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for saying that. Yes, you're right. And it's like, it's, if you aren't made aware, if you can't see these folks, you're not going to want to help these folks. Hiding it doesn't solve any problems.
Yeah.
For sure.
I'll tell you quickly about my mom who lived with us. Mm-hmm. She left the colony because she always claims to be with her kids who left, but she was an adventurer at heart. So when I told her we were talking about starting a bakery, her first question was, what will you do with your leftover bread?
Mm-hmm.
I said, what do you think, Mom? We'll give it away to the soup kitchens. And she said, okay, then I'll pray for you. We weren't going to do that. She didn't think it was a business worth praying for. So to this day, that's something we do very consciously. And right now we're supporting a program that gives individual items to people who are trying to make links with street people. You talk to them by giving them tall grass food, a sandwich, a muffin, whatever, cinnamon bun, to start the conversation too. And that is, so that's our joy. And one of my fun stories is, this is Luik, our head baker. A woman comes to him and said, do you have any day-old bread that's already off your day-old shelf? And he said, yes, we do. She said, I'd like to buy it at a greater discount. And he just goes, no, it's already spoken for. It belongs. I love that story.
Absolutely. It was one of, at our bakery in Regina, that was one of the, I guess, most fulfilling things for me was when we put our sort of our charity program in place for all of our day olds and that with different organizations in the city, and then got to learn what they really needed, you know, and said like, hey, like, you know, some of the stuff that we were giving them just doesn't work for their clients. Right. Like, you know, we didn't have a bread slicer at the time. Right. And it's like, and it's like our clients don't have bread knives. And if you're on the street, you don't have a bread knife, what can we do? And boy, it felt good to change how we did things to help them more. You know, it was sort of like, I never had an easier decision than to say, oh, okay. You know, so I think in my mind, I'm reinterpreting the history here, but in my mind, it's like buying the bread slicer that helped drive the decision, you know, because it was like, yeah,
because it makes it more useful.
It was a need in the community.
Yeah, exactly.
And bread, and I mean, the beautiful thing about the most beautiful thing about bread to me is that it is of use. I mean, it is to people as its natural thing, you know, and I think that there is something about that need, which it will always be present, and we always get a choice in how to bring people back into the picture. And so, asking people what they need, you know, what kind of bread would you like? And I've had so many conversations with customers, and to have those conversations with the customers where someone says, do you make this product? And we're like, oh no, I never heard of it. Maybe we should make it, you know? And then we get the information. Like, how is that? You know, then someone will tell us a story about their grandma making this loaf or there's certain products that we have which come from those conversations.
Oh yeah.
Now able to be wider shared with other people. So yeah. Those kinds of things that's why we do it.
One of our most popular muffins, Morning Glory, which is vegan, was brought to us by a woman who was an early customer. And after we'd been around for a year, she came in one morning and said, she was becoming a lawyer, I have no more time to bake. This is my favorite muffin. You're my bakery. Please make it.
It's so funny because we had something in reverse where after we closed our bakery, one of our customers kept on, would keep phoning Cindy, and Cindy would make her the same. It was a carrot nut muffin. And she had her own little Tupperware containers, and we'd make a batch and call Loretta up and say they're ready for you. And then she'd bring the containers back and we'd do it again. She'd just come to the house. Yeah. Well, you were absolutely right that we could go for 3 hours easily.
Yeah.
I love these stories. I want to make sure I have time. If there's anything that you wanted to make sure that we talked about that we haven't got to yet, because I'm up for anything.
I mean, I had a one thing about like what I was just saying about people. I think that to me is also where tradition comes in. And I think that, you know, I did talk a little bit about, getting recipes from people, that tradition, but just about food traditions in general. You know, I also have a little bit of an academic bent from my early years. I was working at Tallgrass to support my philosophy degree, until I realized that practical matters probably needed me a little bit more. But just in looking at certain, you know, reports about food and history and how different peoples have used food and incorporated those and how important those traditions are, I think that like that is that's a connection to like how something is made, how we use it in our lives. That is the people part of it, right? And so I always like things about method, how individual environments are in, and the food is created within those individual environments, and then the food tradition which emerges from those small environments, maybe often domestic settings. Those traditions then are then given to the next. For the next generation, and then they create their version or their, and there's emotion in it, right? People really want to hold on to it, and there is, but there's also a practical element about how things are made. And so often you hear debates between people about certain kinds of bread, and they say, oh, you know, that's not really how it goes, but then they're like, well, that's how my grandma made it, right? And you can't argue with that kind of individual. And so it's just us trying to figure out how to relate our emotions to each other, you know, within the context of tradition. And those things are super, super important. And because those conversations can happen across generations, intergenerationally within the bakery, we have lots of different age categories. And so those are passed in real time.
Our pie baker is 80.
Yeah. She is.
She won't tell us what's after the zero. Yeah.
But she works in there like a dirty shirt amongst everyone, amongst 20-year-old baking apprentices with tattoos and stuff. You know, like those are all mixed together. And so intergenerationally within the bakery, those happen in real time, but also throughout generations, you know, throughout next throughout generations long past, you know, and generations still to come. So I think we take that stuff seriously. We take people seriously, and that's where, you know, the focus of the.
Yeah, I think I want to close with two things. And one is, if there's bakers out there listening and wanting to start their bakery, I would say do your vision before your business plan. Like really, really spend time on what are you hoping to give the world, society? What will motivate you? Because you and I both know doing the same thing over and over and over takes commitment, discipline. And so you're going to need a vision of what do you want your business to be like? Who does it serve? What's it responding to? That I think is what I, and I quite frankly am pretty excited by the new generation, of which both of you are, that I think that's happening for people, and the charisma that's very special. And then what was the last thing? Forget now, but there was one more.
That's okay. That
was when you're 73. Oh, yes, I know the last thing. Okay. We still believe in billeting special guests. And then we live in an old, all of us live in the core area. And so we have these old Wolseley houses that are conducive to sharing. So if you ever want to come, we'll billet you.
Okay.
Well, and your wife. Well,
thank you so much. And please know that I'm grinding through. Okay, how can I get out there now?
Yeah.
So it's like
come to the folk festival.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah, for sure. I need to I get back to Saskatchewan a couple times a year, and I need to then next time just head a little further east.
So
yeah, exactly. Well, there it is. I came out to Winnipeg with a buddy for a weekend because there was a show going on that we wanted to see. And I had some friends in Europe that I emailed them, and I said, yeah, getting to Winnipeg is easy from my place. I go 3 blocks north and then I turn right and I drive for 6 hours.
Yeah.
And then I went 3 blocks south, and that's where we were staying. Right.
Yeah.
so it's really easy to get there. It's like 3 blocks and then 6 hour drive.
Yeah.
But yes.
Here's my version of that story.
Yeah.
When the husband who I met in Europe first came for the summer, we wanted to show him the Rockies.
Right.
So we said, okay, we'll drive to the Rockies. We have 4 days. And he didn't think about it. So we're halfway through Saskatchewan. And he says, can I look at the map? So he looks at the map. He said, stop the car. You're absolutely crazy. I'm not doing this. This is like going to Moscow for the weekend.
Yeah. Yes.
No, the right map.
Yeah. Well, that was my buddy was in the Netherlands, and he said, I'd be in Copenhagen in 6 hours. He said,
I'd be
in 3 days.
Now, which has led us to understand, Paul says, our concept of far or near is the borders of our country. And he said, in Europe, we used to laugh at the Swiss. If they had to go to the next town, they would pack a lunch. That was a pleasure.
Yeah. It really has. It's a real joy to talk with you both. And thank you so much. And again, thank you for the book. And I'm just absolutely thrilled that I got to speak with you and hear a bit about what you're doing. And I love what you're up to in Winnipeg. Well,
thank
for
you
sure.
for your voice.
Yeah, it was great.
Oh, wow. What a talk. I hope you felt it. I hope you felt something what I felt. I hope you felt more than I felt, really. I'm so grateful for this conversation. Every time I listen to the recording, I'm just back on Zoom looking at their faces and just feeling this huge connection, like just right down to my toes, with this idea of community that matters. You know, if you're not from Canada or you're not from the prairies, you may not know who Tommy Douglas is, but you know, he's kind of the center of it for me. You know, he was a politician in Saskatchewan. Him and his ideas and the ideas that he promoted are what created Medicare in Saskatchewan and Medicare in Canada and universal health care and those ideas. And I've listened to snippets, like he was alive, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and I guess even into the 70s, you know, but I didn't really know about him until after he had passed. But in Canadian culture, he's the guy, right? Like he was actually voted, you know, the most important Canadian of all time a few years back for one of those goofy CBC shows that tries to rank this stuff. But he's an important figure. A lot of what Tabita is talking about is in the very same spirit of what Tommy Douglas talked about. And it just seems so core to how I think and feel and believe. So it was so nice to hear this in Tabita's words and see how these ideas that she's talking about, that Tommy talked about, that Schumacher talks about, is being brought to life in Winnipeg through Tallgrass Bakery. And the other reflection I wanted to share is just how long it takes to make something this important. You know, they've been at this for over 35 years. You know, it's so easy to be impatient. It's, you know, I was like that at Orange Boot. It was like, oh, I wanted it all and I wanted to be fully formed like right now. And I talk with folks quite often that, you know, are like 3, 4, 5 years into their journey, and it's frustrating because they're not where they want to be yet. This talk made me kind of think about how it takes a long time to get to the point where people like Tabita and Ryan are. You know, they're talking about succession planning for another generation of owners here, and that's kind of how long it takes. And I'm not sharing this to say, you know, you got to be patient and, you know, stick with it and just grind it out. I have to think that if they didn't experience any joy over those 35 years, they wouldn't stick with it, you know? And so to me, I think the message in this is you got to find your joy every day. You got to find that little bit of progress and feel good about that little bit of progress, knowing that the whole vision, that's way out in the future. But what joy can you get out of today? What step can you take today that's in service to that vision? So I was so grateful for this talk. You know, we've been having a few of these over the last couple of weeks, this idea of thoughtful, intentional growth, thoughtful, intentional leadership. There's something here. I haven't got my finger on it yet. I'm still seeking it out. Maybe in next week's show, we're going to get a little closer to the big answers here. But I really think we moved the yardsticks a bit this week, eh? Thanks so much for listening. I really enjoyed bringing this talk to you, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Like I say, reach out to Mark at riseuppod.com if you ever want to talk. Head over to bakersforbakers.org. That's the number 4, bakersforbakers.org. If you want to meet other amazing, thoughtful, kind, intentional bakers and bakery owners and share your experience with them, learn from each other, help each other, that's where you go for that. Until next time, work hard, bake lots, keep making the good stuff, but please stay safe, stay healthy, happy baking. Bye-bye.